From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Edward Conlon. He's written a new memoir about his life as a New York City cop, patrolling housing projects, working on the narcotics unit, and serving as a detective. He describes meeting people at the low point of their lives, after they've been robbed or their husband is dead in the back room. And he describes facing the petty thieves and drug dealers. Conlon is a Harvard-educated fourth-generation cop and wrote the Cop Diary column for The New Yorker. Also, we talk with Kyle Smith about his novel Love Monkey, about a 32-year-old self-described man-boy who's looking for true love while writing for a New York City tabloid. Smith is the book and music review editor for People magazine. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush has endorsed Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's plan to pull Jewish settlements out of Gaza while retaining parts of the West Bank, and he stressed that the barrier the Israelis are building should eventually be removed. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
The president and the prime minister met this morning at the White House. At a session afterward with reporters, Mr. Bush praised Sharon's proposal to remove Jewish settlements from Gaza while implicitly backing the existence of much larger Jewish settlements in the West Bank. Palestinian leaders have strongly condemned that aspect of the plan. On the issue of the barrier the Israelis are building in the West Bank, the president said it should be temporary.
And therefore not prejudice any final status issues, including final borders. And its route should take into account consistent with security needs, its impact on Palestinians not engaged in terrorist activities.
The Sharon meeting follows by 2 days, a meeting between Mr. Bush and Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
CIA Director George Tenet testified today that the commission investigating the September 11th attacks, he said the nation's intelligence agencies were hampered by the fact that their databases weren't linked together.
There were at least 4 separate terrorist identity databases at state, CIA, the Department of Defense, and the FBI. None were interoperable or broadly accessible. There were dozens of watch lists, many haphazardly maintained.
Tenet said the CIA and other intelligence agencies were hurt by funding cuts during the 1990s. He said it would take 5 more years to restore the agency's ability to infiltrate terrorist organizations and recruit foreign informants. FBI Director Robert Mueller also testified today, telling the commission that he opposes the creation of a separate domestic intelligence agency. There have been sporadic flare-ups of fighting between the U.S. Marines and Iraqi insurgents in the town of Fallujah, putting the truce there under growing strain. NPR's Philip Reeves reports from Baghdad.
The ceasefire in Fallujah has become somewhat threadbare. There have been reports from there of pretty fierce fighting earlier today, in which insurgents were firing rocket-propelled grenades and the U.S. military were firing rockets and machine guns from aircraft. The truce has reportedly been extended by another 48 hours from today to allow negotiations to continue by Iraqi officials and representatives from Fallujah over how to bring about an end to the siege there.
NPR's Philip Reeves reporting from Baghdad. Stock prices showed little change today on Wall Street, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 3 points to close at 10,378 in heavy trading of 1.5 billion shares. The Nasdaq Composite Index lost 5 points to close at 2024. The S&P 500 was down a point to 1128. This is NPR News. Italy's foreign minister has confirmed that one of the 4 Italian hostages in Iraq has been murdered by his captors. The Arabic TV channel Al Jazeera reported earlier today that it had received a video showing the hostage being killed. It said the video was accompanied by a statement saying that the hostages would be killed one by one if the demands of the kidnappers were not met. And the 4 Italians who were abducted on Monday were working as security guards for a U.S.-based company. Democratic presidential contender John Kerry delivered a sharp response today to President Bush's hour-long news conference last night that centered on Iraq. Kerry's criticism came in response to reporters' questions today in New York City. NPR's David Wellner has more.
Kerry said that rather than offering a different approach to dealing with Iraq, the president persisted in sticking to the same road he's been going down. If he were the president, Kerry said, he would be meeting more with European leaders and UN Secretary General Kofi Annan to find a shared solution to Iraq's problems.
But I think this approach of this administration has been consistent and stubborn in the way that it persists in this American occupation and in proceeding down its own road. It has made that mistake from day one, and it is costing us money, and I think it's costing us lives.
Kerry said he does not endorse a cut-and-run philosophy, but he said the president does. Achieving stability in Iraq, he said, should be the key for withdrawing U.S. troops. David Walna, NPR News.
South Africa's ruling African National Congress Party is widely expected to win today's national elections. Voter turnout was reported to be strong. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Smith Barney, proud sponsor of the Creators at Carnegie radio series, recorded at Carnegie's News and Kell Hall. Smith Barney, this is who we are, this is how we earn it.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Edward Conlon, writes about what it's like to be a New York City cop in his new memoir, Blue Blood. He joined the NYPD in 1995 and has patrolled housing projects, worked in the Street Narcotics Enforcement Unit, and is now a detective in the Bronx. He reflects on crime, danger, and death with the skill of a fine novelist. The best-selling crime writer Ed McBain described Blue Blood as a splendid recounting of Conlon's long years with the NYPD, a book that resonates with a shattering ring of truth and reads surprisingly like a novel. Conlon first wrote about his work in a series of autobiographical pieces for The New Yorker, published under a pseudonym. Let's start with a short reading from his book, Blue Blood.
When you arrest someone, it's like a blind date. You spend a few hours with a stranger, a few feet apart, saying, "Tell me about yourself." You ask, "How much do you weigh?" And, "Are you a gang member?" "Really? Which one?" So maybe I haven't been on a blind date for a while. But you do hold hands for a few minutes as you take prints, rolling each fingertip individually, then four fingers together, flat, and the thumb flat at the bottom of the card. Three cards for adults, four for juveniles. You coat a plastic plank lightly with ink, rolling it from a pad, then take each finger, relax, and roll it on the plank and then on the card. A lot of people try to help you, rolling the fingers themselves, which usually smudges the impression. Sometimes that's their intent. Crackheads often don't have usable prints, with fingers burnt smooth from gripping the red-hot glass pipe. Junkies coming down can go into a whole body cramp and have hands as stiff as lobster claws. Perps collared for robbery or assault might have bruised, swollen, and bloody fingers. You try to be gentle, and you wear latex gloves.
That's Edward Conlon reading from his new memoir, Blue Blood, about his life as an officer on the NYPD. You know, it sounds like there's a surprising intimacy with the people that you arrest. Do you feel that way usually?
Well, sometimes you spend a lot of time with them. And if it goes right, you spend even more time. I mean, every time you arrest someone, you're going to spend hours in the cell and hours bringing them down and hours after that talking to them to try and get them to talk about what they did and what else they might know about what other people are doing. So you try and be closer to them sometimes than it's in their best interest.
You usually also see people at their worst, at their most violent or their most vulnerable. In fact, I'm going to ask you to tell the story of the elderly woman who you walked in on a call, and she was basically, she was alive, but she was decomposing in her own bed.
Yeah, that was really just about the most terrible thing that I've seen. There was an aided case, which is a medical call. We would escort EMS into the projects when they came. It was called an aided case. And in this one, I wasn't sure what the original call was. I was just one of the officers who went along with the ambulance. And we went in, and it was this big apartment. It was a housing project, but I think it was a 3 or 4 bedroom apartment. So it just had a huge feel to it. You were walking down the halls in this room after room after room. And finally, when we got to the last bedroom, there was what we know as the DOA smell, the smell of a dying body. And the EMS was already there, and a couple of the paramedics were around the body, and they were crying, which was not something you usually see, because, you know, these are people who see bodies in pieces and dead babies, really, as a matter of course. So this had to be something exceptional. And it was. In this case, there was this old woman who was on a bed, and it was just a plastic sheet, kind of bare. And she was emaciated. I mean, she was once a kind of heavy woman, but she was really just looked deflated, the way the skin hung on her. And so they were lifting her off that plastic sheet, and then she started to moan. And it was, there were maggots all over, and maggots only eat dead tissue. So this woman literally was dying bit by bit, and she'd been left there. And the terrible, really terrible thing was that she didn't live alone. She had a granddaughter, I believe, and also her daughter, who were in and out. And it was the granddaughter who had called the cops, and we weren't maybe as polite as we might have been, because she was just took this kind of pouty teenager tone. I said, "Well, why didn't you call the cop? Why didn't you call the ambulance?" And she said, "Well, I'm the one who did. So why didn't you give her anything to eat?" She said she wasn't hungry. "Well, why didn't you call an ambulance before then?" "Oh, my mother said not to." And this family had kept her there because the checks went through her. She got all kinds of subsidies for the apartment, for the grandkids, for everybody. She was where the money came from. So they held on to her as long as they could.
What does it do to you to always see people at their worst?
Well, people don't call the cops when they're happy. That's sort of the fact of the job. So it can skew your perspective a little bit, because you just either something terrible has usually happened, whether it's your house has been broken into or a relative has died. You just see pretty much the worst all the time when you're responding to a job. And that's actually why I liked walking a beat so much, especially earlier in the career, because you got to see the ordinary life and the better parts of people's lives. Just walking around, and people would say hello, and they were happy to see you most of the time.
After working as a beat cop, you worked for the Street Narcotics Enforcement Unit. What was the job?
That was to catch drug dealers. We through what's called observation sales. We would go to a rooftop or into an apartment and look out the window and watch the corner, watch the lobby or wherever they were selling. It was pretty much crack and heroin in the South Bronx at the time. And it was interesting work. You'd have somebody in the observation post or OP, and you would just watch to see what happened. I mean, we knew most people. We knew most of the places. And you would see the guys in the corner, and somebody would come up and buy, and you'd tell somebody in the catch car to go pick them up a couple blocks away. And it was the other way the police department does it, though that kind of operations, is called buy and bust, where an undercover makes a buy and people swoop in afterwards and pick up the dealer. But this is more, we didn't have undercovers in the precinct level, and this is more amateur in a way and interesting in another way, because you saw everything. You just got to see how the whole set worked, and it was almost like a nature show, you know, in the felony ecology of the streets. You would see who was the lookout and who was the manager, and, you know, if this crackhead came up, and they might have a guy on a bicycle, follow him for a block or two to see if we were watching. And it was sometimes you felt like you were, you know, the boss the casino, watching all the tables to see whose luck was too good and which guy was standing there purposely and which guy was making a move and which guy is a guy you should keep on watching.
How did you get to watch without being seen yourself?
Well, sometimes we worked in plain clothes, and you could just, you know, we were, a pretty mixed unit, Jamaican guy, an Irish guy, Italian guy, a black woman, and a couple of Puerto Rican guys, or one Puerto Rican, one was Shorter Rican, as he was called by the other Puerto Rican, because he was a little bit shorter than the rest of us. But we could sometimes, you know, when you fit into a neighborhood like this, there's, the black and Hispanic cops had obviously a lot more freedom of movement than the white guys. But sometimes you could, you know, just get on housing authority worker coveralls and walk in the building with a mop, or you could get a Con Ed helmet and march down the street with like that. But or, you know, sometimes I if I was in uniform, I would just walk into a building with a big bag of Dunkin' Donuts. So they didn't expect me to work to be working too hard. But you get in, you set up, and you wait, and you wait, and you wait, and you wait. Sometimes it's very busy, and sometimes it's slow for a while.
You know, I so often see cops or security guards whose job is to just watch all day, and I think, how do they keep focused? How did you keep focused when you were just observing?
Well, you have a point to it. I don't think I could do that if I just had to stand there and watch for anything. But when you have to watch for something in particular, and you know that something is going to happen, or you have to figure out why something isn't happening. Or is it because they're out of drugs? Is it because they heard a cop car go by two or three blocks away? And is that related to them, or is there some robbery a couple of blocks away? Or did narcotics just come through? And are they afraid? And are they right? And was the last customer who just came up to them, was he really an undercover? Were they right or wrong about that? So as long as they're out there and you see them and you know the way it goes on this corner and you know the people are going to be there, there's a point to watching.
My guest is Edward Conlon. His new memoir is called Blue Blood. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Edward Conlon. He's a police officer with the New York Police Department, now a detective, and he also writes. He's written for The New Yorker and now has a new memoir, which is called Blue Blood. You've said that one of the more dangerous things in your line of work is when you have to bust down a door and you're the first person in and you really don't know what awaits you on the other end. Can you tell us one of the stories of how that played out for you?
Well, doing search warrants really are, to me, the most exciting part of a job, because as much homework and research you do about what's on the other side of the door, you don't know what's on the other side till you knock it down. And there may be guns there, maybe drugs, there may be, even more frightening, there may be old people or kids who aren't supposed to be there. So those, when people talk about the most dangerous and difficult part of the job, I mean, they've been in some awful situations. But the things that frighten me most are the idea of something like that happening, where we did one search warrant where we had the guy identified, and he was on parole for robbery. He was moving a fair amount of heroin. He was supposed to be living alone, and we hit the door, and he wasn't there. There was just this elderly Spanish woman who began clutching her heart and hyperventilating, and So immediately called for an ambulance, but we're there. And she said that she lived alone. She didn't even have any children. And so we were really, really concerned. And we called for an ambulance and then saw a lot of men's clothes around. So we knew she wasn't telling the truth either. So I went through the closet, and the closet that had all the men's clothes in it, and began taking things apart and found a big brick of heroin and a brand new .45 in a shoebox. So you never know how right your informant is or how wrong he is until you're on the other side of the door. And once we found the heroin and the gun, the old lady felt a lot better. She began speaking in a more calm and normal voice, and claimed that the couple of $1,000 that we found was really hers and it wasn't her son's. And then the son actually came back because he saw the ambulances, and was afraid that his mother was sick, and though she was feeling much better, he walked in and said, "Who's she to you?" And he said, "He's my mother. You live here?" "Yeah." "Congratulations, you're under arrest."
When you make an arrest, you not only try to get information from the person you've arrested, you often try to get them to inform on other people, and maybe to be a more long-term snitch. Can you tell us something about the best snitch you ever had?
Let's see. Well, the ones who are still working, obviously I can't give up too much about, but they tend to be the ones that I've had the longest relationships with. were just sort of inconspicuous and sad people who could move around a neighborhood and never attract any suspicion, really, because dealers look down on junkies and they give them what they want and they move along, and certain kinds of neighborhood characters can move in just about any of the spots that are out there. Then there are the more one woman who we called Saul was another one of these neighborhood people who'd been around forever and knew everyone, and I think partly because she was a woman, she wasn't taken as a threat in the same way a guy could be. But she was also kind of a serious criminal herself when she was younger. I mean, she would do gunpoint stick-ups, and she would, I think her mother did too, but the whole family was involved with crime and drugs. And she was just pretty ruthless. I mean, she once gave up her nephew, who was wanted for a stabbing, by going to a family party and claiming to be calling a taxi, but instead calling the precinct and say, okay, I need that pickup at 123 Smith Street as a prearranged signal. So not a lot of sentiment involved in this kind of business.
What can you offer in return to someone who gives you information?
Two things, money and freedom.
How much money do you have to offer somebody for that?
Well, it varies. I mean, when I was on patrol and in SNU, it was pretty much all out of pocket. In narcotics, they would pay them basically $100 for a search warrant. Now the city is putting
a lot
of money.
Does that mean $100 for enough information to get a search warrant? Is it
for a search warrant that worked out well, where we got something.
Uh-huh.
But now the city's giving out $1,000 for a gun, and that's a program that we've gotten a lot of mileage out of. If you know anybody who has a gun, you know, you call it in and you work it out with a detective to make sure that it's got. You get $1,000, which is has worked pretty well.
What do you like about that system?
Well, it puts a real incentive to get the gun off the street. And people may be fond of their friends or not too fond of their ex-boyfriend or whoever has the gun, but it's moved a good amount of guns off the street.
Do you respect your snitches? Do you think they're doing the right thing?
Well, you never know what you would do yourself if you were forced into their particular corner. Some of them are pretty cold-blooded, but some of them are just sad. They're junkies, or they've just decided for one reason or another that they're not going to do the time. They'd rather be with their kids, or rather be with their wives, or rather be with their families, even though they haven't spent a lot of time till now with them. But they think maybe in the future they'll get to make up for it.
You write that in some ways the cop code and the criminal code reflect each other in a funhouse mirror, and you're talking there in part about what respect means to the cop and to the criminal. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, respect, I mean, they do resemble each other in a certain way, but I really don't know what respect means sometimes out in the street in the ghetto. I mean, there was one drug dealer when I was a beat cop. I locked him up once or twice, but I'd see him out there and I'd nod to him, and just to show that as far as I was concerned, that I saw him there. But he used to tell me, you know, you're all right now. You're all right, Conlon. You respect me, which was just not true. I didn't respect him, but I mean, I treated him fairly, and I didn't arrest him when he didn't have drugs. If that was his idea of respect, well, so it goes. But sometimes it means a lot less. It just means that you're not attacking me on sight whenever you feel like it. You know, that's not my idea of respect. But cops, especially when they're out in the street, when they are walking alone, walking beats, they do have to make sure that it's understood that people won't even begin to try that. I mean, that people won't jump them, that people won't come after them. So in that sense, a sense of respect, of keeping your distance because you know you're going to get worse than what you give, that has to be communicated.
How hard was it for you to get respect from people on the street?
I don't know. I mean, I walked there. I was there for a couple of years, so people got to know me.
You talking about the housing project now?
Yeah, yeah. And also, I mean, I was 30 years old when I started, so, I mean, I wasn't a kid, really. I didn't really have much of a chip on my shoulder. I'd talk to people and say hello and walk by. But, you know, you do get into these confrontations, especially if there's a group of guys. And that was the kind of classic and exhausting part about of antagonism of the beat. You walk by a couple of guys who may be drinking beers or maybe playing the radio. And you walk by and say, listen, guys, you got to keep it down. We've had complaints. And maybe you have and maybe you haven't, but you know you will if they keep going. So it's just sort of a test to see if they're going to respect you, because you've given them some respect. You've talked to them nicely and asked them for some accommodation, but not to break up the party completely. And you'll see how that goes. And maybe they will, and maybe they'll keep it down. And they say, all right, well, thanks, take care. Or usually, very often, somebody will mouth off, you know, F you, what are you going to do about it? And then that's where the respect comes in. You've got to turn around and talk to them. And maybe they'll back down again and say they're sorry, and maybe the guys will jump in and say, don't mind him, he's a little drunk. As long as there's a reaction that shows respect, then, you know, you can say, okay, guys, take it easy and move along. But otherwise,
but it sounds, it sounds like a lot of people are just going to challenge you. You know,
yeah, and you know, sometimes you can laugh and ignore it, and other times it's a kind of threat that you have to address. I mean, not in an angry way, but just to stay there and show that you're not going to go away. Not certainly not because they want you to.
Edward Conlon's new memoir is called Blue Blood. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics, enduring works of literature in newly annotated editions, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by the Sundance Channel, Film Starts Here, presenting the TV premiere of Peter Fonda's The Hired Hand, tonight at 9, film listings at sundancechannel.com. And from Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Whisker of Evil, A Mrs. Murphy Mystery by Rita Mae Brown and Sneaky Pie Brown, authors of The Tale of the Tip-Off. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, NYPD Detective Edward Conlon talks about his work after September 11th, looking for bones and body parts at the Fresh Kills landfill. And we meet first-time novelist Kyle Smith. His book, Love Monkey, has been described as the American answer to the British bestseller High Fidelity. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Edward Conlon. His new memoir, Blue Blood, is about his work with the New York Police Department. Before becoming a detective, he patrolled housing projects in the South Bronx and worked in the Street Narcotics Enforcement Unit. Part of your memoir deals with what you did after September 11th, and you were assigned to go to the Fresh Kills landfill, where all the remains were sent, and to be one of the people sifting through the remains, looking for bones, body parts, and personal possessions in the dust and rubble. I'd like you to read a short excerpt from that chapter.
There was everything there and nothing. The dirt wasn't even dirt, not earth, but a blend of ash and dust. Concrete walls, wooden desks, the people who sat behind them, broken, burnt, and hosed down. The largest pieces of structural steel were deposited off to the side, but 20-foot sections of I-beams and concrete boulders the size of cars arrived on the trucks. There were little things that had survived and big things that hadn't, and there was a sense of the miraculous and the counter-miraculous. The steel head of a hammer seemed to be attached to a head of human hair, wavy, greasy, and gray, fanning out like an old-fashioned feather duster. What was this? I lifted it to show the mutant next to me in the practiced pantomime of the deafening silent piles. Shoulder shrug. What? Pointing. This? It was a freakish crossbreed, half hammer, half wig. The goggle man lifted his mask to yell, "Fiberglass handle! Heat on fiberglass handle!" There was a lot of bones. There were yards and yards of fire hose. There was white metal from the hulls of the planes. There was a Toyota mashed flat. A lot of single shoes. There were all kinds of documents, some in perfect condition, from Cantor Fitzgerald, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, Aon. I found the personnel file for an Irish Williams with a reprimand for being late in June 1992. I hoped Irish Williams was late on September 11th.
How long did you do this work, sifting through the rubble?
Well, we were there from September, I think, through February or March. March is when it closed down, I think. I think it was through February.
What was the hardest part of day after day going to the landfill and looking for bones and remains?
No, I don't think there was too many parts that weren't hard. It was just an unreal scene, especially at first, where we'd work 12-hour tours. We'd either get there at dusk or at dawn, so you had these brilliant sunsets or sunrises. And Fresh Kills is this kind of man-made garbage mountain, this plateau that overlooks New York Harbor and Ground Zero, as it was just starting to be known then. And it was still burning. So it would be dusk, and you'd be on this trash mountain, and you'd look at the harbor, and you'd look at Statue of Liberty, and you'd look at the remains of the World Trade Center burning, and F-16s would be going through the sky, and it was always kind of windy there, and either this kind of gray dust always was whipped through, and you're in these Tyvek suits, these white suits and hard hats and goggles and masks, so we were all sort of looked like aliens and looking at this very alien scene. And then you would just grab a rake and move through the piles for 12 hours with these 5-gallon buckets next to you. And you would pick out something that looked like bone and you throw it in, or you might find a credit card, or you might find personnel files from, you know, Cantor Fitzgerald or any of these companies that were there that just were... You just knew this was ordinary life for a few weeks before.
How did you end up being assigned to this work?
Because it was a crime scene. What in Fresh Kills, all the rubble from Ground Zero was trucked out and deposited to be examined for primarily body parts, but also what other identifiables we called them. Initially, they talked about hoping to find the black box, but you stop hearing about that after a while. And this was a crime scene, and detectives are in charge of a crime scene.
As important as the work was, did you feel like that's what you should have been doing?
There were times, probably at 5 in the morning, on cold days, when you had been digging and digging and digging, and towards the end you found less and less, where you wondered if this was something that you had to be doing. But somebody had to. So you went ahead. You had all these great Salvation Army volunteers, too, who came up and ran the mess tents and so forth, and they had all their Salisbury steaks and these kind of funny foods that I hadn't seen since my New York childhood, and all these casseroles and fun foods, and they were just such decent people, and they didn't have to be there either. So it was always nice to see them there, and you know, you shake it off and get a little bit of perspective.
You are one of several people in your family who became cops. Your great-grandfather was a cop. You have at least one uncle who was a cop. Your father was an FBI agent. Why do you think it's the kind of job that sometimes runs in families, that generations do it?
Well, an easy guess might be that fathers come home and tell stories about work, and they're certainly, I'm guessing they're better stories than, you know, from the accounting firm. I certainly grew up on cop stories, even though my father wouldn't have wanted me to become a cop. And with my great-grandfather, that was more interesting because he had, by his own choice, sort of cut off that, you know, family pipeline. He'd left my great-grandmother, and that's why he was more of a villain in the family lore than the fact that he was pretty definitely not the most honest cop in the world. I mean, when he retired, he went to run a horse room in Jersey, so he was obviously not unfamiliar with the sporting life.
Let me ask you something about your father. You had actually asked for your family's Freedom of Information Act files, and your father, who worked for the FBI, had a pretty thick file. I think it was from that file that you learned that he was actually in a car accident and killed a woman. Something...
Yeah, he did.
It was an accident, but...
Yeah.
But he never mentioned that to you.
He never did. And that was certainly the most surprising thing in the files, that he he had run a woman over in the early 1960s in a completely innocent accident from all appearances, but also a truly horrifying thing. I from the reports, is that he was driving up Broadway at, I believe, 256th Street, which is right near where I live, and a corner I've passed many, many times without thinking about it, and now I pass thinking about it, where he was driving up the street and an elderly couple was crossing, and a car speeding in the opposite direction made the woman jump back into the path of his car. And it was what was done was done. It was all reported and investigated. But I asked my mother about it, and she said that he said it was just the most horrible thing. He didn't believe it was happening as it was happening. And I was interested in it just because, well, for a number of reasons. One, because it had been hidden from me. But my father was a Marine in the Second World War, and then he was a G-man for almost 30 years. And he had never killed anybody and never hurt anybody, as far as I knew. And these are the most exciting and dangerous-seeming jobs you could imagine. And yet he runs somebody over going home from work someday. And it just seemed odd and sad that it had happened.
Why do you think he never told you?
I don't know. I mean, if it was nothing to be ashamed of, and I have no reason to believe it is, I don't know why it wouldn't have found its way into some cautionary tale about driving safety. You know, I didn't drive at the time. I didn't get a license till I became a cop. So there's maybe no opportunity for it. I think he just felt terribly about it.
When you found out about the story, did it make you feel any more or less inclined to take risks at work, knowing that for your father, the worst tragedy happened just kind of driving home, not on the job?
Yeah, well, I don't think there was anything that I pulled back from out of fear. I mean, you hope you're careful and you're thorough in your preparations and you go where you have to go. But it does sort of incline you to the belief that a lot of stuff is out of your hands, which you have to make sure as much as possible can stay in your hands, as has to be in your hands, but a lot of it's out of them.
Let me ask you about your writing. I just want to say I think you really write terrifically. Your writing for The New Yorker was done under a pseudonym. I mean, for obvious reasons, you're a cop, and although you're not undercover, you don't need to give away your identity and give away the identities of the people who you work with in writing for a magazine. But your new book is not written under a pseudonym. You're a detective now. You're not doing street work like you were before. But are you afraid about how it might affect your work as a detective to have your name out there?
I wonder. Obviously, it's a decision I made, but it does concern me how it could affect my future police career, whether I'll be on the stand and a defense lawyer will cross-examine me about what I did for the story and if there's any discrepancy between a published version and a police paperwork version. And mostly it's to challenge my motives. Why am I here? Why have I done it? Why is he here? I mean, that's what defense lawyers do, and you have to be ready for it. But it's going to be a different cop life from now on, but I think I'll be able to manage it.
Do you want to have more of a writer's life than a cop's life in the near future?
Well, one of the nice things about working full-time as a cop was that the time that I got to write was really a privilege I had to fight for. I mean, I wasn't sitting home all day wondering how I'm going to fill this page. It was, thank God, I've got a free hour. I've got a free afternoon. Let me get to it. So you could think of work as the big procrastination from writing.
It's a lot of effort to procrastinate from writing.
Yeah.
So you worried what would happen if you gave up the work and you're just facing the blank page?
Yeah. I mean, I like getting out a little bit every day.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Edward Conlin's new memoir is called Blue Blood. Coming up, Kyle Smith, the book and music review editor for People magazine. His new novel, Love Monkey, is about a writer for a daily tabloid. This is Fresh Air. Kyle Smith's novel, Love Monkey, is about a 32-year-old self-described man boy who stockpiles electronics, owns 43 T-shirts, watches The Simpsons 3.7 times a week, and flosses 3.7 times a year. His most time-consuming hobby is collecting ex-girlfriends, and when he actually falls for a woman, he doesn't know quite how to handle it. The main character, Tom, writes for a daily tabloid in New York. Kyle Smith is the music and book review editor for People magazine. Love Monkey has been described as belonging to a new genre known as Lad Lit. But our book critic Maureen Corrigan said, quote, "Give me a break. We've had 2,000 years of canonical Lad Lit. Life as rendered in writing from a male point of view is the oldest trick in the book. No, in fact, what's hippest about Love Monkey, and I expect its chest-thumping guy supporters to shudder at this analogy, is the deft way it resurrects and updates the Dorothy Parker style of talking about New York City, brittle, shrewd, self-deprecating, and so very witty," unquote. Let's start with a short reading from Love Monkey.
"I don't have a girlfriend now. I played the field and the field won. This makes me slightly suspect. What's wrong with me? Am I gay? I wish. Nonstop guiltless action, plus you get to be good-looking and tasteful, and all you have to do is wear a condom, which I seem to end up doing most of the time anyway. A lot of vaguely intellectual, feministy New York girls seem to think the pill is a male plot to give them cancer or something, a conspiracy they discuss over cigarettes. Am I unable to share my deep feelings? Do I lack any deep feelings in the first place? Am I just picky? Possibly. But at 32, it starts to hit you. There's a fine line between picky and loser. Despite my flaws, I've had a more or less standard number of girlfriends. I have dated 3 different Jennifers, which puts me slightly below average for a guy my age, and 2 Asian girls, way below average. I have dated girls who quote Joni Mitchell and girls who quote Madonna, girls who cry inexplicably and girls who go all women's studies on you if you call them girls, girls who like to be taken to flashy parties, and girls who like to stay home with Fred Astaire. They all have 2 things in common. Every one of them was better looking for a girl than I am for a guy, and every one of them has improved me in some way. A few personality renovations I owe to them, stopped wearing white crew socks with my khakis, began wearing belt every day, stopped wiping nose on sleeve when anyone is looking, learned key girl terms, such as mule, bias cut, empire waist, blowout, etc., essential to understanding most girl conversations. There are advantages to girlfriendlessness. No one to monitor alcohol consumption. Breakfast cereal, not just for breakfast. Can watch midget boxing if I feel like it. Very little time wasted discussing one's emotional issues and picking at one's family-inflicted scar tissue. If want sexual experience before I go to sleep, no need to be nice to hand all day. During, need not feel obliged to call out my name. Afterward, not required to hold myself for 1 to 2 hours.
Well, Kyle Smith, now that you've made some of our audience laugh and alienated the rest of our audience.
That's my goal.
That's your goal. I'm wondering, like, one of the reviews of your book, the first line was, "Move over Bridget Jones and all her chick-lit sisters." Do you see your book as being like the male answer to chick-lit?
Yeah, it is. It's Bridget Jones from the guy's point of view. It's about a guy who works at a tabloid newspaper and is starting to wonder if he has passed his sell-by date as a bachelor.
Now, the Nick Hornby novel, High Fidelity, figures into your novel. And High Fidelity, the book, which was adapted into a film, is about a guy who owns a used record store, has trouble with relationships, and organizes everything in his life into a series of top five lists. You write, "Every girl I know has read this book, and they all want, or think they want, to meet a guy like the guy in the book. More specifically, they want to meet the guy who wrote the book." What impact did High Fidelity have on you as a writer? More particularly, as the writer of this book?
It was a tremendous impact. I remember when I picked up the book, I was in Stratford-on-Avon in England in 1996, and I read it all the way through on the train back to London, and it was just like an emotional thunderbolt. It just hit me immediately in the heart, and I think a lot of guys read this book and feel exactly the same way. It's like you're reading your own life story, and if anyone feels that way about this book, then I've succeeded.
I'm paraphrasing here, but one of the things that he says is that you can't really have a relationship with anybody unless their record collection could talk to your record collection and get along. Do you feel that way about relationships, too?
Yeah, there's so many things that can go wrong when people are trying to meet and find a connection. You know, I know a girl who was set up on a date with a guy who was both a lawyer and a documentary filmmaker. He's tall and creative and rich and handsome. The girl went on one date with him. She wouldn't even consider a second date because she said he smokes and he's from Queens. I know guys who can't take a girl seriously if she hasn't seen Apocalypse Now. I know girls who can't take a guy seriously if he's wearing the wrong shirt.
Do you have any criteria like that yourself?
The longer you've been around, the longer you start to see that you're no prize yourself, and you'd better, you'd better look a little deeper. And I think the character in Love Monkey is a guy who's starting to plumb the depths of his own shallowness, and maybe he's a little bit better as a boyfriend at the end than he is at the beginning.
There's a passage in Love Monkey after the main character has met the woman who he really falls for head over heels, and he describes what it is that he loves about her. Would you read that passage?
Sure. "She loves blue velvet, but also Meet Me in St. Louis. The Virgin Suicides, but also Powerpuff Girls. She has read Sylvia Plath, but never interpreted her writing as a call to stop shaving her armpits. She's on antidepressants, but doesn't brag about it. She does not wear glasses, but she wishes she did. She does not say, 'You do the math,' or 'At the end of the day,' or 'Don't go there.' She lost her virginity in a treehouse. I want to buy her books and jewelry. Being with her is weird and familiar at the same time, like a memory of the future. You know how when you're young, you always think you're going to meet your ideal? You know, a woman with great hair and clothes who doesn't talk about her hair and clothes? A woman who does not believe 'whatever' is a sentence? A woman who eats steak? A woman who isn't trying to meet Wall Street guys? A woman who neither hates her mother nor is obsessed with pleasing her?"
How did you put together that profile?
Well, I think those two paragraphs took months to write. Whenever I would sort of think of a sentence that was part of this ideal, I would sort of add it to the mix, and there was a lot of writing and rewriting. This is one of the more difficult passages to write because it's not very jokey.
Now, I'm interested in that part, that how he's interested in a woman with great hair and clothes who doesn't talk about her hair and clothes. That's the paradox, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is.
You want the great hair and clothes, but you don't even want somebody who talks about it or thinks about it.
Yeah, we're all superficial and we don't want to be reminded of it, I guess.
You know, one of the things your character loves about this woman is that she likes Blue Velvet and Meet Me in St. Louis. She likes the Virgin Suicides and Powerpuff Girls. I'm wondering if you think on the whole that men and women of your generation have different tastes, and if you can judge men and women who you know based on what they like.
Yeah, we probably shouldn't do that, but we all do. I mean, it's so much a part of our lives, you know, these movies and things that we relate to ourselves. And we make so many assumptions about a person based on whether it's the type of person who would prefer a David Lynch movie or a Farrelly Brothers movie. But as I've always said, dating to me is 2% sex and 98% deciding where to eat. So it's the 98% you probably have to worry about.
My guest is Kyle Smith. His new novel is called Love Monkey. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Kyle Smith. His new novel, Love Monkey, is about a writer for a daily tabloid in New York. Smith is the book and music review editor for People magazine. You were actually in the Gulf War.
That's right.
Which I wouldn't have guessed from reading your book.
Yeah.
Because the character in the book does not seem like a character who would voluntarily be in the military.
Yeah, I didn't work that into the book. It's actually not right for the character. I'm not quite sure how I wound up in the Army myself. I was a sort of left-wing pacifist growing up, and my hero was Hawkeye Pierce on MASH. And I wanted to go to Yale, and I couldn't afford to do it without an ROTC scholarship. And then, much to my surprise, I was not only picked for active duty, but I was sent to the Gulf.
Did you feel like you were suited for the military?
Oh, no, absolutely not. I actually wrote a memoir about being in the Army, which is effectively like David Sedaris goes to war. I felt like the worst person to be in uniform over there because I just wanted to read books. I didn't want to kill anyone. I didn't even want to march. I can barely keep pace with a running cadence.
So what did you do in the war?
I was a platoon leader in an adjutant general company. The adjutant general is the branch of the military that keeps everyone's paperwork. And when the killers went forward, they sort of left us behind, and we were basically speed bumps in northern Saudi Arabia. We were speed bumps. If the Iraqis had decided to move forward and plunge into Saudi Arabia, I definitely would have had tank tracks right down my back.
How did you deal with giving orders as a platoon leader?
Well, I got better and better at it. I mean, they train you pretty well to make decisions and to carry out orders and to give orders and, you know, the saluting and the uniforms and everything. By the time you've gone through advanced camp and you've had all this drilled into you for 6 weeks, then you kind of feel like you know something.
You're comparatively short. Did that affect your sense of authority or power or ability to defend yourself?
In the military?
Yeah.
No, there's a lot of short people in the military, actually. You know, I think the military draws from a poorer demographic than, say, the Ivy League does, and definitely the Ivy League is a lot taller than the military. There's a lot of sort of seething short guys in the military who are looking for a fight, I think.
Did you believe in the Gulf War in 91?
I did. I mean, especially once I got there, we all just wanted to move forward and get it over with. The last thing we wanted to do was sit there for 6 years and try to see if the sanctions would work.
Mm-hmm. What books did you take with you?
Oh, I was reading John Keegan's The Face of War. I think I had History of Modern Europe there with me. and had the soundtrack to Les Misérables.
Did you find men who shared your taste in books and music and movies because those things are so important to you?
In the military, not so much. There aren't too many gentlemen scholars in the military anymore, unfortunately.
So was that a kind of alienating experience since your taste in books and movies and music is so much a part of who you are?
It was, in a way, but I was no more alienated in the military than I was at Yale, because I was just about the only working-class kid I knew at Yale, and in the military, I was just about the only Ivy Leaguer around, so it really was just the shoes on the other foot, but either way, I sort of stuck out.
After you got home from serving in the military, when you were trying to meet women, was it helpful or not helpful to tell them that you'd come back from the war?
Well, at the time, I had a serious girlfriend. I was actually in London seeing my girlfriend when we got the alert back in Germany to get ready to go to Saudi Arabia. So at that moment, I became AWOL, unfortunately. And I made the decision to stay in London with my girlfriend and be AWOL because I hadn't seen her in over a year, and take the consequences when I got back. So obviously, it was a girlfriend I had from Yale. It was right after I'd gotten out of Yale, and she was from a family where everyone, including her, was totally anti-war and totally pacifist. So I wouldn't say that the military is a great turn-on for young liberal women.
What happened after you went AWOL?
Well, I finally came back a few days later, and my commander back in Germany sort of said, well, you kind of pulled a fast one, and you shouldn't have done that. But you're going to Saudi Arabia, and I guess that's punishment enough.
So no brig for you, huh?
No brig for me. I mean, we have an old expression in the Army. What's the worst thing they can do to me? Make me join the Army?
Right.
I took a chance, and, you know, I was 23.
Does that seem very far in the past now?
Oh, yeah, it does. It was a world away. I mean, it was just a completely different time. Nothing could be farther from my existence in Manhattan, where I, you know, go to a nice air-conditioned office every day and sort of swap one-liners with other journalists. And, you know, my worst problem is what kind of coffee I'm going to have on my coffee break.
Well, Kyle Smith, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Kyle Smith is the author of the novel Love Monkey. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio. What does the history of marriage tell us about the current debate on gay marriage? On the next Fresh Air, we talk with John Witte, author of From Sacrament to Contract, Marriage, Religion, and Law in Western Tradition, and Nancy Cott, author of Public Vows, A History of Marriage and the Nation. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.